Hello, welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 37. For this episode, we're going to be talking about Castlevania Bloodlines on the Sega Genesis and also, of course, the Sega Mega Drive if you're in Europe or possibly in Japan. I am Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have back on the show what might end up being like our Castlevania correspondent, Kurt Kalata. Kurt, how you doing?
Hey, what's up?
Well, obviously, we had you on for Rondo of Blood, and this is kind of perfect timing to talk about Bloodlines, first off, because over at Hardcore Gaming 101, you guys had a whole book, and I have it right here, on Castlevania that you put together, and it's now available on Amazon for the ridiculous price of $15. Like, it's like $15 or $16 right now on Amazon, and you guys just had that come out, I guess, for the public this past week.
Yeah, just finally published it last week.
So for people who haven't checked this out, this is not just like Castlevania on the NES. Like, it is a full, like, it is, what is it, like 100 and something pages just all on Castlevania. And it's actually in color, like with pictures on almost every page. Like, it is a high quality print. It's not just some like black and white, you know, crappy, you know, printout.
Yeah, it's 158 pages. It has reviews of every Castlevania game from the original one that came out on the Nintendo all the way up till Lords of Shadow 2. I did reviews for a bunch of clone games and games that are, you know, kind of similar to Castlevania, like Eight Eyes for the Nintendo and The Vampire Master of Darkness for the Master System, which is like basically Sega trying to do their own version of Castlevania. And, you know, trivia and soundtracks and just any sort of miscellaneous stuff that I could dig up about the series.
Including Castlevania, the arcade game?
Yeah, that's the only regret with that is that I haven't actually played it. The last time I was in Japan, I was trying to find one of the few cabinets in Osaka, which, according to Konami's website, had existed. And after walking down this big, huge hallway in the shopping district, I just gave up trying to find it. So most of what I know about that was just from videos and reading about it.
Yeah, for me, just kind of looking through it, I couldn't believe how many Castlevania games that I have not heard of. Like you said, the mobile games and stuff that I guess are just in Japan.
Most of them are. There is one that was made specifically by the American branch for the old Java phones that I had on like my old Verizon chocolate.
Oh, yeah, man.
I mean, it wasn't very good, but you know, the fact that they make a specific version for the American market. Because if you Google Castlevania mobile stuff, there's all these Chinese clones, which they're not really Castlevania games as far as I can tell. Like, it's trying to figure out what's official and what isn't when it comes to those games is a little bit odd, because maybe it's real, maybe it's not. And most of them I don't think are, but they're just sort of interesting to see. Like, one of them they actually did bring out for Android over here. But yeah, they're okay for mobile games. They're very well animated, at least.
Yeah, it's, you know, for anyone out there, if you're listening to this show, like, this book is right up your alley. And like I said, you can just order it directly from Amazon, especially if like you're a Prime member, you'll get it in 2 days. But, you know, just for me personally to kind of look through it, and for someone that is like, all right, I want to make sure if I'm going to get this game and it's available on multiple platforms, I need to know the differences between the versions on the platforms. I need to know what the best version is to get. And like, if it is worth, you know, owning the same game on like three different platforms, just because they all do something a little bit different, or there's something a little bit extra, like Rondo of Blood being spread across so many different things.
Yeah, I put out comparison galleries for comparing the PC Engine and the PSP version of Rondo of Blood, and also between the they did a remake of the original Castlevania for the X68000, which was ported here as Castlevania Chronicles, which it's not like a straight remake. They rearranged quite a bit of stuff beyond just redoing the graphics. So there's a lot of comparisons about between the original game and other things that sort of inspired it.
Yeah, that's a weird one. I remember getting that on PSN for the PlayStation 1 downloads, and that is that's an odd version of Castlevania, I think. But let's talk about Bloodlines. So what we're going to do, since this soundtrack, and I'm going to continue to my campaign with Greg Stewart of just saying, you know, the Genesis is capable of very good music, you know, from using Castlevania Bloodlines as another example, including a lot of the Konami games that came out on the Sega Genesis platform. Bloodlines comes with a fantastic set of tracks. So we're going to take a quick break for that, and then we're going to be right back with the history of Castlevania Bloodlines. Hey, it's just Kevin to give you a quick heads up that for the first 10 minutes of the show, we had some problems with Kurt's mic, but they get worked out real quickly. And after the history segment, everything is all set. Talk about the history of Castlevania Bloodlines, and first thing that was really surprising to me is that this was a really late release on the Sega Genesis, or at least relatively late. It came out in North America on March 17th, 1994, and I guess one day later in Japan on March 18th, or I guess that would be technically roughly the same exact time because of time zones and stuff like that. Of course, it came out from, developed and published by Konami. And probably one of the most interesting things for me with this game is the development history. And, you know, Kurt, you're going to talk a lot about this, but I started to think about this, and I really think of Castlevania as a Nintendo and as a Sony platform franchise where, really on the Sega platforms, we only got this. And of course, you got the version of Symphony of the Night on the Sega Saturn. But this is going to work out perfectly with the release of Digging in the Cart. It's a great documentary series. If you listen to that last episode with Nick Dwyer, he's the writer and producer on that, talking about these fantastic composers over in Japan that really helped shape the way that music has evolved, and just the importance of the fantastic music that was done in the 8, 16, and even earlier bit eras. But this is terrible. I'm going to butcher these names, but I'm going to do my best. Michiru Yamane, who I hope I got that right, and I apologize if I didn't.
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Perfect. She worked on other series like Rocket Knight Adventures, and of course on the Sega Genesis and Mega Drive, and Sparkster on the Super Nintendo, and then of course also on the Genesis, that, you know, supposed to be exclusive to the Genesis platform. I remember a story being about that. But also Contra Hardcore, which had a crazy soundtrack, contributed to that. And of course, like we mentioned previously, Symphony of the Night, she would later go on to work on that. And just a fun side note that was mentioned on Wikipedia, said though she once admitted to have worked under extreme pressure and deadlines, the soundtrack met the standards of the previous entries and is highly regarded on its own for its gloomy atmosphere. And that's one of the things that we'll probably end up talking about later. This game is a little bit interesting also because of the time that it is set in the early 20th century. So you get some weird, almost like late steampunky, sort of setup in the levels and with the enemy designs. And one of the interesting things with this game is that, you know, there's two characters that you can pick from the start. Sometimes at the end of Castlevania games, you'll unlock access to a new character. Like in Castlevania 3, you're going to be able to, you know, play as multiple characters as you progress through the game and as you, you know, beat those bosses. But you have John Morse, who, in terms of biography, was born on December 12th, 1895 in Texas. And he's the current wielder of the vampire killer whip. I guess that was passed down to him as he was a descendant of the Belmonts. Also, you have Eric Lacarde, born on May 3rd, 1892 in Spain, and uses the Alucard spear. So you have, you know, two different you know, characters that you can play as, and in doing so, you get pretty drastic differences in play mechanics on how you're going to want to play the game. And some other interesting things, like you can unlock throughout the game while you're playing, if you level up your weapon all the way and you do a secret code in the options menu, you can actually unlock classic tracks that are remade for the Genesis hardware that will play. And this is one of those games in that 16-bit era during censorship and stuff like that, that things got weird. And when it was released in Europe on the PAL territories, they couldn't even use blood, I guess, in the title. They had to call it Castlevania: The New Generation. And of course, a lot of the blood and stuff was removed, or the blood was changed color to green and things like that. Like all the standard stuff we would get used to when it came, or people in the PAL territories had to get used to. And another weird thing is that they actually changed the the sprites of Eric Lacarde to look more masculine and to not look so feminine like it did he did in the Japanese version. So that's the basic stuff that I got. But Kurt, I know you're coming with a bunch of stuff. I mean, you literally have a book on Castlevania, so I'm sure I'm missing a ton of stuff that's interesting on there.
Okay. The thing about John Morris is that this is where Castlevania tried to put the Castlevania timeline in with the Dracula novel. Because John Morris is supposed to be the son of Quincy Morris, which was, one of the guys from Dracula. And I think he was he got killed near the end. And I remember when I was getting back into high school, that's what kind of compelled me to read the Dracula novel, to find out what this Quincy guy was and whether it was actually integrated with the Castlevania. And it really has nothing to do with it, because the whole storyline is that John was kind of watching this battle that he was having, and he watched his father get killed, and that's his motivation to go out and do it. And of course, they never mentioned his son. If you look at the timelines of when they say he was born and when the novel took place, none of it works out. So it's really sloppy, but it's still kind of interesting, you know, the way they tried to do that. Thing with the blood is that one of the big reasons is that, you know, coming back around like 92, 93, that was when Nintendo was still very big on censorship. So the fact that a Sega game, you know, Castlevania was coming out on the Sega platform, that meant that it could be as bloody as it wanted to be. And I mean, we had heard that, you know, that things kind of got gleaned over in Super Castlevania 4, and I mean the censorship wasn't really that big, but this is something that, you know, you can see is something really, really bloody and horror like even though it's not really that bad. Like the title screen is the goriest thing about it, really, because it's a pool of blood.
Yeah, I mean, I just that was kind of like the thing. Even I thought they loosened it up a little bit with Mortal Kombat 2, but you know, clearly they're doing things in this game that they wouldn't have done on the Nintendo platform. I can't remember. I don't know if there were any differences in Dracula Double X where they were able to you know, have some more gore and violence in there or not.
Very little. You know when Richter kind of disintegrates into blood?
Yeah.
I think they turned it into like white. It just kind of fades away, or it was they kind of toned that down. But I mean, Dracula X didn't really have very much blood anyway, so it was really very minor.
And also, this is one of those games that, unfortunately, like a couple Konami games, I think it was this and also Contra Hardcore, some of the later Genesis games, when they did like a second printing, Majesco did the, you know, printing, or they did the publishing, and the games came in those damn crappy cardboard boxes after all those great years of hard plastic, you know, cases that a lot of the Genesis games came in. So if you are looking for this game, like, it's probably going to run you about $20, maybe a little bit more loose, just because price of retro games are just going through the roof. But if you want to find one in one of those hard plastic cases, you're going to be spending a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, and I think I want to say I've never actually had an instruction manual for this game. But I think the one from Majesco reprint is also in black and white.
Totally. Yeah. It's like, oh, man, they sucked with stuff like that. I remember getting just those late Genesis games, and I don't care what it was, but you just get a cardboard box and just like it would immediately disintegrate. It's like those Super Nintendo boxes. They're just not around as much, and people have them. They get to put them in those stupid plastic cases to preserve them just because they are deteriorating by the second. But This is a crazy weird game. Anything else? And obviously the two characters are one thing that separates this game quite a bit, at least in the earlier Castlevania games. But you know, do you know if there was anything that was any reasoning behind like having that two character set up? Was it just to like offer more, you know, variation on the ways that people could play? And I mean, it seems to me that playing as Eric is a lot easier than playing as John Morris.
That's definitely true. There's people I've talked to that, you know, they say to me they don't like Castlevania Bloodlines. I'm like, did you play as Eric or did you play as John? Because playing as John is kind of weird. Like, there's something about the way his animation is off. Like, he walks too fast. His whip snaps are a little bit too quick compared to the other Castlevania games. He's also left-handed, weirdly enough. That's something that always kind of bothered me. But compared, Eric, he just his moves have more oomph. He just feels a lot better to play as. And he is a lot easier because when I was replaying it through, I was able to get to like the fifth stage without running out of lives. There are some slight differentiations, and there's one or two areas where the paths branch, and only one character can get through them. I kind of wish that they had done more with that, but they really, really didn't.
Let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we're going to talk about really, you know, Kurt's memories and history with this game, just because this is another title that I am brand new to. So stick around. We're going to be right back with that. And then, of course, we're going to talk about revisiting the game and what it does or how it holds up in 2014. Going back to 1994 in the heat of the 16-bit wars, and Castlevania is coming out on a Sega platform. I can't believe it. But for you back then, Kurt, was this like on your radar? Was this something that you had to check out?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I was super excited about it because, you know, well, for the 16-bit wars, I went with the Sega Genesis because I totally bought into the marketing about, you know, Sonic the Hedgehog and how much cooler he was and Mario and Nintendo. But I was still super jealous about, you know, all the Konami and Capcom games and that sort of stuff. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in particular. So I remember the Electronic Gaming Monthly when it came out and they were like, Konami's coming to Sega. And I think it's when they announced they were going to do Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Hyperstone Heist. I don't remember exactly the order they unveiled, but they were doing stuff like Rocket Knight Adventures, which was very clearly kind of trying to do the whole fast rodent thing. Like, as far as the mascots platformer games went, that was definitely one of the better ones of the era. And like, what I think was interesting is that you saw that the games came out like on the same day. I think that initiative was really drawn by Sega's success in the West, because you know, in Japan by 1994, like the Genesis was just barely hanging on over there. But the popularity over here is what propelled them to start to get into the market, even though it did eventually get there a little bit late. So I was super hyped to it, but since I was still, you know, like 12 or 13, I didn't actually buy it. I did rent it when it came out, and I really enjoyed it. I can't remember if I beat it. I do remember the magazine at the time that I was reading. They were kind of so-so on it. At the time, the perception was that it was a huge step back from Super Castlevania IV visually. It's one of those things that sort of show that the Super Nintendo really was superior to the Genesis. They had weird complaints that like the sound effects sounded strange, and the fact that you could see cracks in the walls for finding meat. There's a link to a site that I stuck in the Google Docs document that sort of linked to what the reviews of the time, and most of them were pretty positive, except for GamePro that was kind of down on it.
I mean, not to, to get on like a, you know, Bloodlines versus Super Castlevania debate, but I think Super Castlevania is a fine game. But I always got turned off about how you are, you know, so zoomed in and, you know, the sprites are gigantic, but you're just so close to the action, where this is like pulled back a little bit more like, you know, your Castlevania, Castlevania games on the NES or in even Rondo of Blood.
Yeah, that's my, the same thing I have with it. Like Super Castlevania 4, like, I mean, that was basic, since it was a launch window game, it was big on the tech demo stuff, because it was like, look at how good the music we can do, look at how the gates we're using our sprite rotation effects, look at how big our characters are and the way he can swing around their whips. And that was great for how amazing it looked, but from a gameplay balance standpoint, there's something that really feels off about it, because the way the character jumps is kind of strange in comparison to how large he is. The fact that your whip is so gigantic kind of negates most of the sub weapons, because you can just whip in any direction or just get in any reach. But with Bloodlines, the character proportions are about the same as they were in the Nintendo game. So I think it feels a little bit different.
Yeah, maybe it's just because I've been playing all these other Castlevania games, but you know, over the last year and a half or so. But you know, for me, this felt just, it felt more like a Castlevania game than I guess Super Castlevania, you know, 4 would to me at least.
What's interesting about the 16-bit Castlevania games is it's not a clear evolutionary path, because I mean the exact people that worked on those games are kind of clouded in mystery. But as far as the 16-bit games, most of them were made by completely different people. Like Castlevania 3 and 4 were developed roughly simultaneously. So that's why the fourth game, it doesn't have the multiple paths or multiple characters, because that just wasn't a thing. And at the same time, there were three different people simultaneously developing the X68000 version, the PC Engine version, and the Mega Drive version. So they were, you know, they're basically like four different approaches to the Castlevania formula. Started on the Nintendo. So that's why there's some games that they seem like they might be missing stuff. It's just because that's the route that the developers decide to take it. And it's not necessarily all bad either.
Yeah, and I think the one complaint that I've heard over the last couple of years, like whenever this comes up on forums and stuff like that, when of course you have to go, you know, Sega or Genesis versus Super Nintendo, and you got to compare whether it's you know, Contra 3 versus Contra Hardcore, and like actually it's like Hyperstone Heist versus Turtles in Time. It's just like all these Konami games, which almost had like a, you know, a cousin or even a, you know, like a brother sister relationship in the games. You always had to compare and contrast it to. And with this, like people would say, oh well, Super Castlevania 4, like it made the series go farther, because you could do, you know, you could use your whip in multiple directions instead of just, you know, forward, back, and up, or not even up. I mean, just forward and back, and then like a crouch.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that seem to think that that's a step backwards, like not being able to whip in multiple directions. But I kind of disagree with that. Like, it definitely feels better, but at the same time, what makes Castlevania like? What is the feeling of Castlevania is trying to deal with those control constraints. Mm-hmm. I mean, like Bloodlines offers some niceties. Like if you're Eric, you can stab upwards. If you're John, you can also whip upwards, but you have to be jumping. It is kind of weird. I mean, there are some things that weren't done as well. Like you can swing on things with John, but it's not really all that useful outside of one or two spots. It's actually kind of clumsily implemented compared to how it was in Super Castlevania 4.
I just want to warn people if they need to. I know this game isn't the easiest. I always like to give these out in case they're still working. The Konami game hint line is 1-900-896-HINT. That's 4468. Just keep that, write that down right now, just in case you want to start playing this and you get stuck on stage 3, which for me was the hardest.
The main thing that I really loved about Bloodlines was the whole globetrotting thing.
Totally.
Because, I mean, the first game takes place in Transylvania. It has the whole retread of the first level of Castlevania. And then after that, you start going to different places. You used to go to the Atlantis Shrine, which was a, like other Castlevania games sort of had that as a setting, even though it didn't really make sense. Then you go to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, a munitions factory in Germany. Was after that, you have the Palace of Versailles in France, and then you go back to some other castle where the climactic battle is. And I think it really made for a lot of interesting settings, and just for a lot of like weird different things that they could do with it.
Totally. All right. Well, let's kind of cap this in terms of, you know, where you would put it in the context of what was out in the time. I know you didn't own it, but you got to play it. Would you put it up in the higher tier of Sega Genesis of the Sega Genesis's library, I guess?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a Castlevania game, so
yeah,
it's definitely up there.
All right, well, let's take another break, and we're going to be going back to 2014, and we're going to see how this game holds up. And for me, playing through it for the first time, that was for more than 5 minutes. We're going to see, I guess, how it holds up for someone that's never played it before. So stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back in 2014, and like I said, you're going to have to make sure you jump on eBay soon, because this podcast has a habit of driving prices up. Not a lot, but at least a little bit. At least that from the Neo Geo Pocket stuff, I guess, is completely gone from Akihabara. Like, no one could find anything last week, but...
Does that mean I'm sitting on a gold mine of all the Neo Geo Pocket Color games I got 10 years ago when they were clearancing out in those blister packs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. Those packs of, like, 10 games or 8 games or whatever. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Or 4 games, I guess. So for me, I picked this game up, and I had it kind of sitting on the shelf for a while. I just knew I wanted to play it, and... of course, thanks to this podcast and doing this show, you know, having completely played through Castlevania 1, played through Rondo of Blood, Symphony of the Night, and now I've dabbled with 3. I haven't beat it. Dabbled with 2, but it's kind of a pain in the butt, and I'm saving that for a while for later on. And, of course, Castlevania 4, which I played maybe about halfway through. I'm going to say, like... This game kicks ass, and for this is coming from someone that is, you know, plays a lot of retro games, but you're gonna get a lot out of this game if you want to pick it up and you want something that is probably not the hardest of it's definitely not the hardest of the Castlevania games, at least from what I played. It's a little bit more forgiving, but I will say I got to play it through a nice S-Video modded Sega Genesis to my PVM with a 6-button Genesis pad, which is probably the best way to play it. I don't know, Kurt, like I found like most of the 3-button Genesis pads that I've found these days, like the D pads are all messed up and the buttons aren't very responsive even after cleaning them. So, the 6-button seems to be the way to go.
Unless I want to specifically like remind myself of what it was playing a Genesis back in 1989, I definitely go with the 6-button. Well, the same thing, like I still have to get my Genesis S-Video modded because its output's pretty muddy. But for a while, I would hook up my Genesis through like a crappy old RF connector just because that's like the way I remember playing it. It's just totally a good nostalgia playback, even though it's, you know, the interference is terrible.
Yeah, turn it to channel 3 and, yeah, you know, flip it on. But that is one thing. If we're talking about Genesis stuff, just the benefits of having that steady stereo output on the front is great. But then, of course, the real drawback of just the terrible composite out, although the thing is capable of doing some really good video output if someone mods it. And, of course, you know, you get a cap kit for it or whatever and just, you know, replace some of the caps on the board, you're going to be good to go. And even those are a little bit easier to find today because tons of people are doing it. So if you want to jump on eBay and you don't want to pull out the soldering iron, you can do that. But the reason why I wanted to ask you about, you know, what it felt like to play the game in 94 is because I mean, in terms of a Genesis game, if you want to put it in that context, like this game has just an amazing tone, an amazing atmosphere to it, you know, with the combination of the graphics, with it having it be a little bit more violent. And, of course the soundtrack just does a great job, like that peanut butter, and chocolate of putting those two together and making a fantastic 16-bit, game. But, let's just talk about the graphics for a second, because the Genesis, I mean, you know, people say like, oh, this, you know, Super Nintendo looks way better, but like for this game, you know, for, you know, a 16-bit Genesis game, they were doing some super cool stuff with like, you know, rotation. And, of course, like there's the iconic reflection of the water on the second stage where you're like, holy crap, I can't believe my Genesis is even doing this.
Yeah, that was one of the big things of looking forward to Konami on the platform, because they had technical wizards going back to the Nintendo days. Mm. So seeing what they could do with it was one of the most impressive things about it. And just being able to see how they would do effects like that, even though the Genesis didn't really support them. Because, of course, back in the Super Nintendo era, everything was like Mode 7, scaling, rotation, mm-hmm. and Genesis doesn't have that. Like Bloodlines would sort of do things in a way that fakes those effects. And I wish I knew more about the technical things behind them. But you can sort of see like the Leaning Tower of Pisa section.
Yeah.
When you start going upwards and it sort of automatically scrolls up, like it's not really doing the same sort of background rotation that a Super Nintendo can do. What I think is doing is the background is sort of shifting up and down on a scanline basis, mm-hmm. but the platforms itself, they're kind of tilting up and down. Like if you look at the platforms, they're moving up and down, but they're not rotating. So when you do it in conjunction, it sort of looks like it's wavering back and forth, even though it's not really in the same way that like Super Castlevania 4 did it. There are other new things like that, like Rocket Knight Adventures. If you played that, they did something similar with the whole reflecting. They did it a little bit more clever way because in the section, there's this lava that you can sort of see. Mm-hmm. But there's these areas where Sparkster, you can't see him like on the top side of the screen.
That's right.
But you can see him on the bottom. So you sort of have to like think upside down so that you can see where you're going.
Yeah, you brought up Italy, and it feels so like you feel so badass just like destroying those statues and like creating really your path throughout the stage, or even just you know, destroying platforms or supports below it and having the platforms drop down so you can, you know, drop down or jump back onto it. And those are gigantic sprites, and it's kind of funny to see like the huge you know, the heads from that you're destroying of these gigantic statues, and having, I guess it's screen tearing or the sprite tearing or something like that.
Yeah, there's some sort of manipulation that it's sort of just to make it look like it's sort of falling over, but not really.
Yeah,
there are others just sorts of like really neat faking effects, like later on when you're climbing like the outside of the thing, you sort of see the tower piece in the background, and you're sort of like going up in a spiral around, and mm-hmm. as you go up and more, you see like the platforms you're already on. And when you get to the top and you fight the little gargoyle on things, like it's just the effects it does for spinning around look really cool.
That part sucks. Like I fell off those things like probably 15 times, just like having that, you know, spiral of platforms that kept rotating around. But, you know, just talking a little bit more about the graphics, it wasn't only, you know, just like the huge sprites and stuff like that. But, you know, of course, there were just I don't even know how to describe it, but there was just so many different, you know, parts in the game where I felt like, man, this is just like this is the next step. Like this felt like Castlevania 4 more than Super Castlevania 4 did. Where you could just see there's like a lot more detail in the environments, like having, you know, the glass shatter and fall down on you, whether it's like in the first stage or stuff like that. But with all that being said, or even like they were doing stuff almost like Vector Man, like when you're fighting the in the clock tower, like the boss that was made out of gears, like it was doing like weird, like almost looked like Vector Man like stuff.
I haven't
seen in other games.
The fancy sprite manipulation. That was that's something that, you know, back in the Genesis days, we sort of took pride in the fact that it had a faster CPU, mm-hmm. which I mean, in technical terms, doesn't I mean, it doesn't, just because something has a slow CPU doesn't necessarily mean it'll slow down or can't do that stuff. It all depends on the programmer. But when you're a kid, you sort of like to think that way, because it gives you, you know, a little one up of the blast processing stuff.
Totally.
But what you saw in a lot of the Genesis games were those sort of segmented sprites things. It was big in Vectorman, but it's also big in Gunstar Heroes.
Yeah.
So the first boss of Castlevania Bloodlines is that huge knight made of all those different parts, and as you would attack it, it would start losing its limbs, and then sort of like the knight from Monty Python the Holy Grail would just kind of like ram into you and try to kick you.
Yeah, like that last stage of the boss battle, he's got no arms, he's just, you know, kicking you.
Yeah.
I made it about halfway through the game. I started off playing the game as John Morris, because I went into it. I'm like, okay, this guy looks like a Belmont. He has a whip, and that is how a Castlevania game is supposed to be played. So, like I said, I got to that third stage, and that's when I started dying like over and over again, just because really the difficulty for me in this game was more of the platforming. It wasn't really, you know, getting through the level and defeating enemies. Like, I felt like I had a pretty good, like playing a bunch of Castlevania games, you get a really good idea on how to read like movement patterns of enemies and stuff like that. So you get, it's almost like reading a language. It's kind of weird to just jump into a new Castlevania game and already know how some of the enemies are going to move, even if they aren't from previous games. But I made about three stages in, and I'm like, all right, I'm not making it any further. Just to have like a break, I'm going to try playing as the other character. And then I blew through the game, you know, to a large extent, just because how huge it is to be able to attack directly up when you have things flying above you. And, of course, and like, especially that boss, and even the third stage, like that gargoyle thing, like being able to, you know, just shoot your spear up, you can get way more attacks in much shorter period of time. And you can even go with a diagonal attack as well. And you can charge like almost like Super Mario Brothers 2. You can duck down and charge up and do like a huge leap upwards and use that to avoid enemy attacks, whether it be boss battles or just other enemy attacks, and even to get into specific areas that were not accessible by John Morris.
There's another trick, and I know it applies to Eric, and I think it applies to John too, is if you power up your whip like to the third level, or power up your weapon, and hold down the button, you'll sort of let out the weapon hold for like a split second, and it'll do another hit of damage.
Yeah, it's a... It was weird discovering that stuff. And even I got to a part in, maybe it was the third stage where you get to a point as John Morris where you're like, man, this is a huge gap. Like there's a huge, you know, gap below me. There's no way I'm going to be able to get across this thing. And I started like jumping up. And as soon as I jumped up and I try to like make that leap, I'm like, holy crap, I can grab the ceiling with my whip.
Yeah.
And I can swing. I'm like, this is like 1994, where of course in 2014, we'd have like 14 different prompts telling us how to swing on the ceiling and use all of our different abilities and stuff like that. But, just to discover that, I'm like, holy crap, I didn't know I could just start swinging across the levels. Maybe the previous boss battles would have been a lot easier if I could have avoided their attacks on the ground like that.
Yeah, that's one of those things where Castlevania 4 did it better, where there's something that very clearly looks like a whip hook. Mm-hmm, yeah. So you would know to test it out, but you might not necessarily know that you're like, and you have to time it right too. So you like the edge of the last part of the whip will hit the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And you could do that at everywhere. But outside of that one, I think it's one of the only points where you really ever need to use that, is at one spot in, I want to say the fifth level. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was weird to see stuff like that. But I, you know, like I said, I started going through the game as Eric, and I just had a lot easier time with it, just because some bosses, like, or some bigger enemies, like you would get two hits in with the spear, because it would, you know, get one hit going into the enemy, then almost one hit on the way back as you retracted the spear as well. And I don't know, I just, it felt a little bit less like Castlevania, you know, in the beginning, but then I got over that because I'm like, hell, I'm still, you know, fighting big ass bosses. There was tons of mini bosses throughout the game. And I so many times I would get to what was a mini boss, be like, all right, man, I can just beat this guy. I got like one piece of health left. I had to beat him. And then I'd be like, where's my red orb?
It's yeah, like still going.
Where, oh man. And even like in stages, like you'll have, And some of the stages, I think there's like 11 parts. Like there'll be like 3-11.
Yeah, that's one of the cool things about that game, because in normal Castlevania games, the stages are broken up into 3 blocks in a boss battle. And for the most part, the theme in those blocks are, you know, roughly sort of the same. But, you know, in this game, like every block you do, a lot of the things they change visually, a lot of the things you're doing in that particular block is completely different. Because mm-hmm. It's going off memory. It's like in the third level, when you start the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you're in that section where you're outside and you have to fight those minotaurs that pick up the pillars.
Yeah.
And then you go in and you're in a section that's like a red tower. They have to go up sort of like the parts of Super Castlevania 3. And then there's another area where everything's kind of slanted and you have to jump up. And then there's another regular area where there's mummies. And then at that point, it goes to the part where you're going upwards and it's tilting. And then it just is always giving you something different to do.
Totally.
And the downside about the games is only 6 levels, but yeah. At the same time, each level is, they feel a little bit longer than they were before.
Yeah. And I totally forgot about this, but just talking about like the gore in the game, like at that level, you know, we have those minotaurs, but there's also like, you know, flying eagles with spears or whatever the hell they were. And you can actually like, you know, sometimes if you attack them and you hit them right in the head, you'll decapitate them.
And you see the little blood pixels spurting off. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, holy crap. This is a Genesis game. And I'm looking at the box right now, and it's rated GA, appropriate for all audiences.
Yeah. That early rating agency, there are some things that I have no idea how they got away with that. Like somebody was clearly like falling asleep, because that is definitely not a GA sort of game.
Yeah. It was the volunteer, you know, rating system that Sega put together before they got yelled at by Congress, I guess, or whatever, the Senate. I don't know.
That was actually a result of that. But they were like, well, we're going to self-police it. This is a system that we're going to use. There's another completely different system set up for other things. I saw in PC games. And then eventually ESRB came in and they were a little bit more consistent. Lunar 2 for the Sega CD is another one. They're like, how did this rated this way? There's all sorts, like, the intro of the game features a naked woman who, you know, it's like a Barbie doll, but it's still like a video game.
Sure.
And there's all sorts of like innuendos and stuff like that. Like, what?
Man, I can't. You brought that up, just like the rating system on the PC, and I haven't thought about that in like maybe 15 or 20 years, but now I'm totally remembering the it was like a temperature gauge, and yep. There was like 5 levels of the temperature gauge, and you pick up like Duke Nukem 3D, and it's like fully, you know, all the way at like 120 degrees or whatever the hell it was for that temperature gauge. But that is man, ratings, that was a weird time. What was a couple of things I also wanted to mention in that, you know, you've played a ton of Castlevania games, but maybe it's just because I've been playing a lot of these, is that I am, maybe it's just getting easier, but I found this game to be relatively easy, and especially the boss battles. I didn't feel that they were very difficult, at least on normal.
A lot of that also has to do with you have a longer health bar. Mm. And, you know, back in the old games, you had, when you got through them, you had like 16 bars of health. Each hit would take like 4 damage. So you die in 4 hits. This one you have like 20, 24, and each hit maybe do like 3 or 4. So yeah, it's definitely harder than Super Castlevania 4. But I would say it's still easier than the 8-bit games. Especially because by the end of the game, there's a boss rush. So when you're playing through the game the first time, you can afford to be kind of sloppy in those early boss battles. But later on, when the little Grim Reaper comes out, when you have to like hit those cards and replay them, like, you can't afford to take too much damage.
Let's talk about the last stage, stage 6, where you know, it even says like final stage. Like, all right, I'm ready to go. I'm gonna beat whatever incarnation of Dracula you got for me this time. And I start going through the stage, and like you said, you have that boss rush, which isn't too bad, because again, if you figure out like the patterns for the enemies, like our most bosses like had like 3 different attacks or something like that. I think literally the hardest boss for me was always the boss made of gears, just because those attacks are a little bit harder to avoid when he jumped from side to side of the screen. But it was just like that 6th stage. I'm trying to think. Maybe there might be 10. Bosses that you have to face, whether it be like a boss that turns into another form or into another form, but I think there's like 10 bosses that you have to fight in that 6th stage. But you're lucky where you get the ability to, you know, if you beat one set of bosses or a boss, you get to the next section of the stage, whether it be like 6-3 or 6-4, and then that's kind of a checkpoint as long as you have continues or lives left. And even if you continue, you don't go all the way back to stage 6. You start at like 6-4, and then you get 3 more lives to go and fight the boss again.
Yeah, it's a little bit more gentle like that. But the 6 stages, I saw you'd posted a picture of it on Twitter when you get to the upside down area.
Oh, yeah.
That was, I remember I was talking to somebody relatively recently about that, and you get to the part where the screen is kind of fragmented.
Yeah, what the hell is that all about?
I don't know what it was ever supposed to be, but he asked me, is like, this is an emulator glitch? And I'm like, yeah. No, that's the way it's supposed to be. When emulators first started coming out, it had a hell of a time getting anywhere in the 6th stage because it just couldn't handle whatever the hell the Genesis was trying to do there. So in the old days, yeah, they were emulator glitches. Even on, I think the emulator I had for my Android phone, it didn't process that level correctly. But yeah, who knows what's going on. But it's a neat little trick because like different parts of the screen are fragmented, so you can sort of see where the body of your character is, but not the legs. And you can kind of see the platforms, and you have to just kind of guesstimate where you're jumping or where you're hitting. It's very strange.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like it was hard. It was just like it was weird. Like it was broken into a couple segments, and then you go to the next part of the stage, and then you're just upside down. I'm like, this is too bad. Like it's just, you know, kind of like when you flip the, the mansion or whatever, the castle in Symphony of the Night a little bit, I guess. I don't know. It wasn't too bad. But this game, I just thought it was... It was a hell of a good time. Like, I just felt like at the end of the game, and I got through the whole game. I can't believe I ticked off another Castlevania game on this. I never thought I would ever beat a Castlevania game. But after beating this with, like, 2 pieces of health left, like, 1 hit point left, I just thought it was a great ride. Like you said, the enemy diversity and the level diversity was pretty amazing for the time. There was just – felt like they threw in tons of stuff, whether it be – you know, mini bosses, whether it be just 1 mini boss or 2 mini bosses in a level, pretty decent boss at the end, even if they were a little bit easier. But of course, at the end of the game, it says, hey, you know, I know you beat it, but maybe you should try expert mode.
Yeah,
of course.
It gives you a different ending, too.
Is it impossible in expert mode?
It's been a long time since I played in expert mode. It's definitely harder, but...
Maybe that might just be, throw it up on YouTube and take a look at it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. And actually, one more thing I want to mention, just in terms of like the enemies, and maybe it clicked with me a little bit more just because it was takes place in the 20th century. So like you said, in that munitions, supply center or whatever, like having enemies just like one-offs that would come at you, whether it be like knights that had wheels attached to them and they would come like charging at you, or even one that had like 2 miniguns attached to its arms and was just like dumping bullets at you the whole time. It just felt like a much different Castlevania game, but at the same time, it still had all the, you know, the tropes of, you know, the games that I was used to playing on the NES or even, you know, the PC Engine version.
You know, I can't remember if I talked about it when we were talking about Rondo of Blood early in the year, but at that time we were trying to get this. There's a beta for Bloodlines that we were trying to get dumped and released, and it still didn't ever quite get it out there. But for a long time, like, it had definitely gone through some graphical changes, and there's this part in that level where you would fight against a blimp. There's another area where it looked like it was in like a gold melting factory or something like that, and you would have to jump on platforms or else you would fall into the molten either gold or lava or whatever it was. And some of the enemy designs were also completely different.
What a weird game. Just even this, like, the inclusion of the classic soundtrack in the game. Like, you can, if you want to just go on YouTube, you can listen to the Genesis versions of, you know, tracks from the NES or the Super Nintendo. And even like the, you know, Simon's theme, like when you hear that fire up in that sixth stage, I'm like, holy crap, they actually, you know, brought that music over from Super Castlevania 4. And the Genesis, to its credit, does a pretty damn good job of recreating that track in the organ sounds and all.
I actually prefer the Genesis version of that particular track. It's such a good song.
Totally, totally. Maybe we'll finish with that right now, but we're going to take a quick break and stick around because we got some stuff to talk about, including game giveaways, some TGS stuff, and some cool, interesting content that's going to be coming down the road. So stick around. We'll be back in just a second. Okay, before we get into the other discussion stuff, you know, Kurt brought up a great point just in terms of relation of Bloodlines and future games.
Okay. Portrait of Ruin, like the second game that came out for the DS and mm-hmm. one of the Metroidvania games, is from a storyline standpoint, it's the sequel to Castlevania Bloodlines. Like the main character of that game is the son of John Morris. His name is Jonathan, confusingly enough. And the big point in that game is that when Koji Igarashi came onto the series, he tried to create a mythology surrounding it as a producer to create a cohesive storyline. And the thing about the game is that, you know, John Morris wields the castle, the vampire killer whip. But as he turns out, he's not a real Belmont, and they're a little bit sketchy about what that means. But the events of Castle Bloodlines end up killing him. Eventually throughout the course of the game, you gain the spirit of the Belmonts and, yeah, that was a little bit weird. And the other thing is there's a mysterious character in the game named Wind. And I don't know if it's too big of a deal to spoil a game from 8 years ago, but that's actually the ghost of Eric Lacard. And it's one of those weird things because, you know, like the way that like Hideo Kojima games, they would bring in like characters from the original Metal Gear, like the Nintendo ones, who they didn't really have any dialogue or personality or anything like that. So, I mean, like Eric is like a blank slate. You saw him on the cover. You didn't know who he was. Mm-hmm. So I have a character be like, I'm actually Eric Lacard. And some of the two main bad guys of these games are these two Gothic Lolita vampire girls. And they're actually his daughters.
What?
Yeah. So, oh, I mean, man. It's he did some weird stuff. I mean, like Curse of Darkness, one of the PS2 Castlevania games, is also the storyline sequel to Castlevania 3. And he kind of botched that relationship because the only thing the same is that Trevor Belmont is in it. And he's kind of a jerk in that game, too.
If I have not played Portrait of Ruin, the only one that I've played on the DS, I played Order of Ecclesia, I think.
Yeah, that's the one that came after that.
Okay, so I played that. Is it worth going back and getting Portrait of Ruin if it's like under $20?
I love Portrait of Ruin because it is a sequel to Castlevania Bloodlines, even though the storyline connection is kind of goofy, just because it leaves the castle. Because Dawn of Sorrow, which was the first DS game and the sequel to the third Game Boy Advance game, Area of Sorrow, it was a really good game, but like you were kind of stuck going through the same castle environments. I thought it was kind of wearing out its welcome at that point. But Portrait of Ruin is, it kind of takes a globetrotting thing again for Bloodlines. So one level is in like a British town. Another one is in Egypt. One isn't any place in particular, but it's like this upside down circus. And another one is a kind of a boring forest level. So just having those different environments was really neat. The problem with the game is that, like, once you get done with that section, it's a little bit like Symphony of the Night in that you have to retread all the old environments except they're reversed.
Oh, great.
And it's that part of the game is kind of tedious and drawn out. So for that reason, that's like a lot of the fans tend to put that in the lower tier, even though like I enjoy it also because the music is fantastic.
All right. Hell. Buy now with one click, Amazon. You got me. All right. And also, if people are wondering, you know, the great description on Amazon.com, their only bullet point is a quality product by Konami Digital Entertainment. Jesus. Put some time into these descriptions.
Another good thing to mention just about Castlevania and Portrait of Ruin in general is you can get Castlevania Bloodlines for like 20, 30 bucks cart only. Hmm. The Japanese version, Vampire Killer, is one of the most expensive games on the system. Like the site that I order from, I think they're selling a box copy for like 25,000 yen.
Holy, okay.
Yeah.
That's still 250 bucks.
Yeah, it's not to the level of like Eliminate Down, but it's definitely on the higher ranks of the stuff there because it came out so late in the system's life, especially in Japan where like support was just really dropping off for it. And it's part of a series that, you know, is not very popular over there, but still has some cult level of faith. And the same thing has actually happened with the DS games. Like I was looking over there, like Portrait of Ruin, they cost like maybe 70, 80 bucks for a DS game. That's actually pretty unusual. The same thing with Order of Ecclesia. They're both very rare. Which I had imported Portrait of Ruin back when it came out. So like I had sold it to a local store because I had bought the English version. There's no reason for me to have it. But I'm like, if I could go back and sell it in Japan, I'm sure I'd get more money.
Jeez. Yeah. I'm going to have to keep an eye out for that stuff. I mean, it's like hell, like if you own the US version, I guess I don't need the Japanese version. That's just
it's one of those cases like Contra Hardcore is also more expensive, not to the same level. But there's actually reasons you would want the Japanese version of Contra Hardcore because it's easier. Like that game is it's incredibly difficult. In the Japanese version, you can take multiple hits and you can just activate cheat codes. Like I think they were sort of taking that idea that Americans rented games too much, and they made it too difficult.
Damn it.
Yeah. But for Vampire Killer, like other than the alternate box art and the pretty boy version of Eric in the intro, like I've heard people say they're really minor difficulty tweaks. And if they are, they aren't really noticeable. But I mean, unless you're a collector, there's not really any reason to go for the Japanese version.
I'll still keep an eye out for it. I'm still going to be looking for a copy of Bare Knuckle 3.
Oh yeah, I picked that up. That's definitely one that you should probably get because they changed in a lot of stuff for the American version, almost all for the worse.
Yeah, I've had the U.S. version for a while, and it's just like, why do I even own this? Like everyone says, the Japanese version is way better. Difficulty, you know, is way more balanced and stuff like that. So I'm gonna wait to talk about it on the show until I get my hands on the Japanese version.
Yeah.
All right, cool. And also, actually, speaking of that, might as well bring this up real quick. Starting like 3 weeks from now, I'm going to be spending like 60 days in Japan. So I'm going to try to get together some interesting content, whether it be, we've been talking for almost since the start of the podcast that I do that episode with 8-4 on Zelda 2. So we'll record that while I'm out there and possibly Super Metroid. But if you have ideas or anything that you guys want in terms of video content or audio content while I'm out there, just shoot me a message on Twitter or just through the contact page on backofmyplay.com. I'll be happy to see if I can do any of that stuff. But this is going to be my little test drive to see if I can actually work remotely from out in Japan and then, potentially not get super aggravated with some of the things that Westerners seem to get aggravated about, living out in Japan. But we'll see. It will be an interesting test. Also, we have Back My Play hoodies at teespring.com/back. BIMP Japan hoodie. I'll put the link for that in the show notes. It has the Japanese console version of the logo on those, and they go for $26. It is the lowest possible price that I could give you on Teespring for selling 10. And by the time that you hear this, it might only be 24 hours left. So check that out. When the @BackOfMyPlay Twitter account hits 400 followers, and I think we're like 10 away, I'm going to be giving away a code for New Super Mario Brothers U on the Nintendo North American eShop. So if you want a code for that, make sure you're following @BackOfMyPlay, and I'll be announcing that once we hit 300. Also, We have a Patreon at patreon.com/backinmyplay. I think it's at like $18 per episode. But if you enjoy what we're doing with the show and you want to help support it, and that could be something that allows me to do some more interesting stuff down the road, whether it be buying equipment or traveling to events like retro game shows and things like that to record stuff, that's what you would be supporting. Of course, the bandwidth and the all that stuff that goes into the show. And of course, Kurt, I know people, if you're listening to the show, you should be checking out Hardcore Gaming 101. And I know you guys have a Patreon up now, so people can support the content that you guys are doing too. And I think it's just patreon.com/HG101.
Yeah, that should be right.
Yeah, and check that out, just because, you know, again, if you guys enjoy this stuff, like, not a lot of sites are doing the retro game stuff. It is something that you want to support if you enjoy it. And I guess in terms of like TGS stuff, I don't know if there was anything that really came out. There was nothing like retro game related. The only thing that probably the biggest news came out before that, which was a new Nintendo 3DS. I don't know if that's on your radar, Kurt, in terms of picking that thing up or not.
It's kind of cranky that they do something like that. I mean, I guess if I really feel like I need to play Xenoblade on the go, which, I mean, that's a good on the go game given how huge it is. Mm. But I mean, it would depend on software support.
God, if they just have a headphone output that isn't made for like a 3-year-old with delicate ears,
yeah, that would definitely be better.
That's all I want. Like, even with earbuds, that thing at max volume is not loud enough for me. And I have, you know, I have 28-year-old ears. I got pretty good hearing, but still, that thing, compared to the Vita, is like a has some like child protection restriction on the volume output on that thing. And like you said, like Xenoblade, I never played that on the Wii, so I'd be happy to, shell out some cash to play that, but doesn't matter, we're not going to get it until next year anyway, so
yeah. If they go back and retroactively put the new controls into Kid Icarus Uprising, then maybe that'd be okay.
Holy crap, yeah, actually I played like an hour and a half of that and I just could not handle holding the 3DS with the stylus and all that crap. Like,
yeah, it works really well for the flying stage, and then once you get on the ground, it's a disaster.
Exactly. All right, cool. I think that might be about it, just in terms of like episodes coming up. Like I said, I'm not going to be gone for like 3 weeks from now. So I think we're going to be doing Star Fox 64 with Peter Brown. And I think I forget who else it was at GameSpot, but we're going to do that. And I think I'm going to be saving Soul Blazer for potentially John Riccardi, if we can get the schedule stuff lined up. And then I think we're going to do Kirby on the NES, because again, I want to try to make sure I get all this stuff out of the way before I go, because if I play anything out there for the show, it's going to have to be the Japanese version for all that stuff. Not that Kirby would be a big deal. All right, Kurt, you guys have anything coming up on Hardcore Gaming 101 that people should check out? Anything that, is around the corner?
Well, I'm working on the next book. Like, I tend to have a tendency to do things concurrently. Like, the Castlevania book got held up for several months for all sorts of reasons. But at the same time, I was working on the next one. It's all focusing on Konami. So it's on the Konami shooter series, which include Gradius, Parodius, Twinbee, a lot of the other. They did easily like a dozen different one or two off games, like Thundercross. The Odomedius games were the more recent ones that they put out. The second one actually made it to America, and they're not really all that great. But yeah, that one sort of finishing up work on should hopefully be out at the beginning of next year.
Oh, cool. Yeah, those are really fascinating, just for now that I've got a Sega Saturn, just getting into some of the stuff that is on there, like the Gradius. I think it's, what is it? No, it's Darius Gaiden is the game that's on there.
Oh, that's actually a separate series.
Okay.
They just have similar names. But yeah, the 32-bit era, that's where I started getting into it, because at the beginning, when I got my mod on my PlayStation, that's where they brought out compilations that have like the Salamander games, which is Life Force. They have Twinbee, which is like the later two ones, Daytona Twinbee and Yahoo Twinbee. The Gradius Deluxe Pack, and Gradius Gaiden, which is like, it's like the Symphony of the Night of the Gradius series, and as far as like graphically and musically and how advanced it is. So that was a big thing that turned me into a Konami shooter fan.
Is there anything, I know there's a couple compilations on the PSP that people have been telling me to keep a lookout for. Are any of those any good?
Yeah, I get all of them. I mean, the Gradius one came out in America, so you're pretty good on that. That includes the first arcade versions of the first four Gradius games, and Gradius Gaiden, again, which is the first time that one had ever shown up. The other ones are Twinbee, Salamander, and Parodius. And they're not comprehensive, but they do include a lot of good stuff. Like Twinbee includes the original Twinbee, the Super Nintendo game Poppin' Twinbee, the arcade versions of Daytona and Yahoo Twinbee, which are the same as on the PlayStation and Saturn collections, along with a completely new remake of the Game Boy version. Salamander includes Salamander and Life Force, which are like variations on the same game. Salamander 2, and well, the best thing about that is a game called ZexX, which is like the penultimate Konami shooter, which they released in the arcades in the early 90s, and it must have been a big deal at the time, but they never ported it anywhere for a long time, so it was sort of a lost game until it got emulated in a meme, and it's just like a visual treat. It's a fantastic game.
Interesting.
And yeah, then Parodius, which it has the MSX game, the arcade game. There's, I think, five of those. The only problem with that collection is that the Parodius games, they have all their music is based off of music from different sources. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of classical music and things like that. But for that compilation, they sort of realized that some of the tracks they used were not in the public domain. I mean, I don't know how parody law works in Japan, but I guess they just decided to sort of re-record some of the music using different songs. Like in one of the games, the first level track is That's the Way I Like It by the Casey and the Sunshine Band. And I guess when they came around and re-released it and realized that the internet was more global, and they're like, okay, we got to change this.
From what I've seen and what I've heard, you know, from being out there and from talking to people out there, the Japanese just don't give a crap about copyright at all. In terms of like reusing stuff on news shows and TV shows and stuff like that, they'll just use it and just not care.
I remember tuning into some, we have a, you know, a local Japanese language channel around here, and we heard like some music from Evangelion. I'm like, what are they using this for? Yeah. And I mean, they're definitely a little bit lax than they are in America. But it's kind of on a case by case basis. Yeah. Like they kind of look the other way, but they'll litigate if they feel like there's a reason to.
Jeez.
Like, recently there was a case, I think SNK was, or Capcom or somebody, they were complaining about this one manga because it used these images from their old arcade games without their permission. And I guess they wanted a piece of the slice. And it was really weird too, because like in America, if that happened, they would send a cease and desist or they would just sue them. But in this, they started like a whole criminal criminal thing. So the police came into their offices. It was really strange.
Oh yeah, they like raided their offices or something like that, right?
Yeah. And also, like, when it comes to the Castlevania book specifically, like, you know, the Sega book has recently been brought out in Japanese. And I was talking to the translator, and he wants to do the Castlevania one next. And I was asking, like, what would you like to title it? Do you want me to use the Castlevania game, or do you want me to ask the artist to create a new logo for Akamaj or Dracula? But, I mean, the series name has been sort of inconsistent over there anyway. And he's like, stick with Castlevania, because Konami has been known to be kind of litigious for fan-made things. Because back in the 90s, I don't know if it was a video or just a regular manga, but somebody did a porno version of the Tokimeki Memorial Dating Series.
Of course they did.
And I mean, there's a whole sub-industry for that sort of stuff. But most of the time they look the other way. But Konami shut that down. So he was like, maybe if we use the Castlevania name, they'll sort of overlook it.
Jeez. All right. Well, you mentioned it, so I want to bring it up again. But, you know, the Castlevania book, Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Castlevania, it's available on Amazon.com. And like I said, I've been kind of looking through it the last couple of days. And it is like, damn, man, you did such a great job on this book. Like, it just looks fantastic. There's, you know, images from all the games. You break down, like I said, all the different versions. You even have sections dedicated for all the different CD soundtracks. Like, if you want to, you know, import those from Japan, and all the different references throughout the, you know, games that have, you know, come out, whether it be like shooters or even like Kid Dracula and stuff like that. This is just something that if you care about Castlevania, you should pick up, and you're crazy to not do it if it's $15 on Amazon.
I'd also like to note that for the cover, like I specifically asked the artist to make it Bloodline themed by putting John, Eric, and Elizabeth Bartley on there.
Awesome. Just because
they were some of my favorite characters.
Very cool. That's going to wrap it up for this episode. But like I said, you know, the best way that you can support the show right now is to jump on iTunes and submit a review for the podcast on there if you enjoy what we're doing. And You can follow me at Kevin Larrabee. That's L-A-R-R-A-B-E-E on Twitter. You can get at Kurt at HG underscore 101. And of course, HardcoreGaming101.com. You should be on there and checking out that stuff. And I think next episode is probably, like I said, going to be Star Fox 64 or Kirby. But after that, I'm going to be heading out. So if I do miss a week, I apologize. But it's just from settling down. I'll make sure there's something on backofmyplay.com to check out. But like I said, yeah, Kurt, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk about Castlevania. I think at some point, probably going to have to do Castlevania 3. I'm going to have to finally fight through that game. But
good luck.
Yeah, I know. At least I got that, you know, 14-pound Famicom cart with all those extra chips in it to make it at least sound good on the way. So, that'll do it for us for this time, and we'll catch you all next time.
All right. Thanks for having me.